Okay, good morning. So, last time there was just sort of an introduction and a little bit of what are the issues surrounding wireless networks. Quality of service is an issue with networks in general. And it's in particular going to be sort of problematic over wireless links, although we'll see more on that later. The main things you ever analyze are loss, delay, jitter, and I probably should have thrown in there bandwidth, so how much raw bandwidth can a user get over a link? Okay. And we saw that traditionally there have been voice and packet networks with very different characteristics, mainly because they were designed to carry different sorts of data. And we see that persisting with wireless versions. There's a lot of different types of wireless networks. And they're all sort of, again, designed to fulfill a specific purpose and carry a specific sort of data. Okay, and so then we said a few words about sort of the generic design of classical networks, so multi-hop networks, and how can we do it? We can either have a circuit switch network where we're reserving resources, or a packet switch network where the resources are shared out among the packets. And then, again, to have in the back of your mind, your data networks, your packet switch networks will have a layered architecture. Okay. Now, it's nice to have this sort of basic networks picture in your head, but what we'll see is that actually a lot of what we do in wireless doesn't quite fall into that category. In particular, a lot of what we do in wireless networks is concerning a wireless access link, so a single link, and how we're sharing out the resources of that single link. Okay, so what's happening sort of back in the back end of the network becomes less important. Again, wireless networks have arisen from voice and packet switch networks, so in particular the cellular networks, the voice networks, don't adhere to the layered architecture. So it's nice to have some idea about regular basic networks, but we'll, again, be going over the important features of the wireless networks as we look at sort of different examples. Okay, we're going to start from the bottom up. So we're going to look at a digital comms model. Okay, so we're transmitting bits, essentially, or data from point to point over a radio link. And so what do we do in order to make that happen? Okay. Now, most of this is drawn out of William Stalling's wireless comms. There are newer editions of that, but it's this is pretty basic stuff, so any edition will do. Okay. And so, in particular, if you look at that, it's chapters 6 and 8 that are relevant. Okay, Goldsmith and Black go into a lot more detail on the radio aspects. And so if you like comms theory, then they'll, again, be a lot more detailed about the comms theory aspects. Thank you.
Okay. So, again, what we need, our digital comms system is designed to efficiently or effectively convey information from a sender to a receiver. And with, in our case, the physical transmission of the message should be over a radio link. Okay. Now we're going to look at two components of this comm system. Pretty much today what we're going to do is see how we can process our data, how we can package it up to be suitable to send over the radio link, and then next lecture we'll actually talk about the properties of that radio link. Okay. And over radio, the signal that you're going to send is a sinusoid. You do something to that sinusoid to make it represent bits, but you're sending sinusoidal signals. Okay, so the information that you can transmit originally would have been, particularly if you're thinking about voice, you would have been sending an analog signal. These days, all signals are going to be digitized, so the signal we send over the link is digital. And so again, early systems, particularly with early cellular telephony systems, send analog. There's a lot of issues with sending analog over wireless links, and it's a lot more efficient to send digital signals. If the signal you want to send is a voice, well, you just code your voice into a digital representation. Okay. So, we'll skip to the picture. There's a number of steps that we go through, again, to make this signal suitable to send over the radio wave. Again, if we start with an analog signal, like a voice signal, we digitize it. Again, bandwidth is at a premium over radio channels. So typically we use a source encoder to compress the signal to try and reduce the amount of information that we're sending. Okay, and we'll look at how we can do that for voice and video. We've said that our wireless link is a lossy link. We've tried to reduce the information that we send here, but we also need to send some information so that we can either detect or correct losses. Okay. So at the end of this, again, let's think of it as a stream of bits to send, and those bits, again, have to be represented as a sinusoidal signal. We are going to look at some fairly basic techniques for translating bits into sinusoidal signals. And we'll see that exactly what technique we use has an effect on the loss properties and the bandwidth efficiency properties for the channel. And once, again, we have our sinusoid, we can transmit it over our radio channel. We'll talk about the radio channel as its own lecture next week. Obviously, at the other end, we have to decode our signals, so turn it back into bits, check and see if we have errors, possibly deal with the errors if we have errors. Sort of notice and possibly correct. And if we've compressed our signal in any way, we have to recreate our initial signal
from the compressed signal.
Okay, so what we're going to do today is to look at each of those boxes going forward. And then see how what use they are. Okay. So, in terms of the performance of the system, well, there's a number of things. Again, you can list the bit rate or the resource demand as a performance parameter. I left that one off. Improving the channel capacity or dealing with what you're given in terms of channel capacity and error rates, so dealing with error rates. Okay. And so we're going to talk a little bit about performance of systems and how we sort of quantify performance. Then we're going to again go through each of the blocks and again see how each of these things impact on the performance of the system. Now, do you guys all take comms theory now? The fourth years? No? Okay. Don't worry about it. we just do some basic results from comms theory. Okay, and the first one is that we cannot send an unlimited amount of information in any given period of time. And what limits that is the noise in the system. Okay. So noise limits the capacity of a channel and also obviously can introduce errors into the system. Okay. Now there's a number of sources of noise. The first one is thermal or white noise. And this is the one that we view as impacting capacity in the system. This is what makes it impossible to send unlimited amounts of information. Okay, and N0 is a noise density, so it's the amount of noise per kilohertz. Thought I fixed that. And it's a function of the temperature and multiplied again by this constant, that's 10 to the minus 23. Okay. So, typically this is white noise we view as, again, limiting channel capacity. Other forms of noise essentially provide interference to our signal and introduce bit errors. Okay. So, if you have multiple signals on the same medium, then these signals potentially interfere with each other. Okay, and that's called intermodulation noise. Crosstalk is similar, having signals on different channels, but also sort of interfering with each other. And impulse noises are sort of unpredictable noises that, again, tend to destroy bits or series of bits. So it can either be So the noises can either be sort of from generated signals or, again, just the atmosphere, lightning, loud noises, whatever. Okay. So, we have these fundamental restrictions on our systems, saying that you can only send a maximum bit rate through, or a certain bit rate through a channel of a certain bandwidth. And this is Shannon's channel capacity theorem. And what it says is that the capacity is related to the bandwidth, and then the signal-to-noise ratio. Okay, so the signal-to-noise ratio is the signal power, average signal power, divided by the average noise power. Okay. So you can increase your capacity by increasing your signal power, but once you have once you fixed your signal power and your noise, then you have a maximum capacity. That represents a theoretical limit and isn't necessarily achievable by any physical system. Okay, so again, the noise traditionally is your white noise. It's possible to think of coding and modulation as contributing noise factors. So any sort of, say, loss in signal representation can be translated into a noise factor and added into that equation.
I don't understand the last idea. Why would coding add something to a noise?
Well, say, for instance, you're coding your voice signal, then you sample it, and then you represent each sample as a certain number of bits. There's a certain amount of error introduced by that, and you can view that error as a noise process, so it's just a little fuzzy around the signal. Okay, so just a note, signal-to-noise ratios are frequently expressed in decibels, and a decibel is 10 log 10 of your quantity, so just be careful when you are using Shannon capacity or a number of other things we'll see through the course to note whether it's in decibels. If it's in decibels, obviously you can convert it out, reverse the process. Okay. So, the signal-to-noise ratio is a time average of the signal power and the time average of your noise power. When we send bits, we're sending bits that they have a fixed duration. Okay, so that they have a certain time span. Okay. And so our bit energy to noise power density then gives a measure, it's essentially a measure of the signal to noise over the duration of a bit. And so again, N zeros are density, so if we have a signal of a certain bandwidth, that gives us our
noise is N0 times the bandwidth. And the signal energy per bit is the average signal times the duration of the bit. So the duration of the bit is 1 over the bit rate. So EB over N0 then is our signal power times the bit duration divided by N0, and obviously we want to relate and our noise to the average noise, so we can add VT top and bottom, and that gives us on bottom N0 VT becomes N, and so we have liquid energy, and then our noise is VT over N, and so rearranging that, we get our signal-to-noise ratio times our bandwidth divided by our bit rate.
Just what is S?
S is our power, our average power.
Of the signal?
Yeah. Yeah, so we're trying to relate our bit factor, so EB over N0 is sort of a measure per bit. And we're trying to relate that then to the signal-to-noise ratio. And what we see is it's a signal to, that EB over N0 is the signal-to-noise ratio times VT over R. And again, what we'll see as we go through the lectures, VT over R is sort of a significant factor. And essentially what it's doing, R over BT is a measure of what bit rates you can fit within a certain bandwidth. Okay, so the bandwidth efficiency. Obviously, the higher the bit rate in the bandwidth, so the more bits you're packing into a fixed spectrum, and the better. Okay. So, another related concept of spectral efficiency. So, the spectral efficiency. So the bandwidth efficiency was the bit rate relative to the bandwidth. The channel efficiency is your channel capacity relative to the bandwidth. Okay, so again, first is sort of as a practical implementation. This is as a theoretical limit. Again, and so we can rearrange Shannon's capacity theorem to get our signal-to-noise ratio in terms of our spectral efficiency, and we can also then if we equate, if we assume that we can transmit at our maximum capacity, then we can relate our EV over N0 to our channel, to our spectral efficiency. Okay, and doing that, you can determine sort of how much energy per bit you need to achieve a certain spectral efficiency. Okay, so you can either look at spectral efficiency or bandwidth efficiency. Okay. So the amount of energy we're putting into our signal or putting into transmitting our bit has an impact on the capacity of the system, so at what rate we can transmit. We will later see that the amount of energy we put into our signal also has an impact on the error rates. And that's not terribly surprising. You'd think the more energy you put in, the clearer the signal was relative to the noise, the less error you would get, and that's true. But what we'll see, which is sort of interesting, is it depends on the modulation technique.
Is the capacity, what is the capacity? Is it with the bandwidth or how much you can handle? Or?
It's a, yeah, it's a theoretical cap on the bandwidth. Oh. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, there's a lot of work which, you know, in terms of signaling to increasing the capacity or the channel efficiency through signals, using wireless systems, and we'll sort of return to that as we go along, although we, you know, again, we're not going to sort of dig deeply into the comms theory behind it. We'll just mention that different, again, modulation techniques are giving us certain results and what's the best we can do. Okay. So, voice is an important type of, and sort of fairly special type of data that can be sent. And so, we'll look at digitizing voice, and then we'll follow on pretty quickly with how you compress that digital signal. So, in order to represent an analog signal digitally, you have to sample the signal. It's one way, you know, the most straightforward way to do it is to sample a signal at some rate and then encode that sampled signal as bits. And the Nyquist sampling theorem tells us that if we want to fully recover a signal from its sampled version, we have to sample at a rate of twice the signal bandwidth. And this result is used as the basis for how you encode voice. And so the bandwidth of a voice signal is taken to be 4,000 hertz. You might possibly lose some
some details, but probably not. If your bandwidth is 4,000 hertz, you need to sample at 8,000 samples per second.
Okay. Do the bandwidth always go from zero to the number, or like if it's
no? I mean, it's going to go. But again, where I don't know what the whatever the frequency of voice, it's not zero to some number. Okay. It's and a starting point to 4,000. Yeah. Okay. So we then sample. We have our samples. We need to. The samples are real numbers, really. So we need to encode them using bits. And typically we use 8 bits per sample. Okay, and this gives us our 64 kilobit per second voice representation. Okay, and so this would have been sort of the telephony standard. Okay. And again, telephony with a wired system, you could essentially provision your system to provide those as many of those 64 kilobit per second channels as you needed. Okay. So that method of digitally representing voice is referred to as pulse code modulation. And again, we can say that adds a quantization noise. So again, you're not getting the exact value, you're getting something around it, and we can think of that as being a noise factor. Okay. And the amount of noise is related to the number of bits used for quantization, and the more bits you have, better. Okay, so again, you have your sampling at twice the maximum frequency, and then when you sample, you have quantization levels, and your sample is just rounded to the nearest of those levels. It's possible that you don't want your levels to be completely uniform. You might want to have sort of more samples for lower amplitudes, and so you don't need to dip. You don't necessarily need to have uniform levels. Okay. So, Richard, with Trevor, if you have your sampling rates at 8,000 samples per second and 8 bits per sample, you have a fixed data rate of 64. Kilobits per second. And so for the telephone, sort of classic telephony, that was fine. for wireless systems, especially for early wireless systems, that was considered a lot of resources to be using. Okay. So the question then becomes, can you send less information and still have a recreate your signal to an acceptable level? So source encoding refers to the attempt to compress data from a source in order to transmit the data more efficiently. And the encoding can either be lossy or loss-free. And what we'll look at is voice and video encoding, and typically what they're going to do is rely on similarities between one sample and the next sample. Okay, so we'll start by looking at speech coding methods. And there's two basic flavors. The first set it sort of tries to minimize the amount of data sent based on our PCM technique. And we'll see that we can get down to fairly low bit rates, but the quality of the signal decreases a lot. So a second group of techniques is what's called model-based coding, and here we get away from the idea of actually transmitting our samples to actually modeling the voice signal, sort of curve-fitting your voice signal, and then sending the parameters of that model. Okay. And we can get down to quite low bit rates, not great quality, but by adding in a bit, we can have reasonably low bit rates and a decent quality signal. Okay. So again, what I mentioned was that a lot of these techniques, they use you're assuming that the difference between one signal and the next is not huge, it's not spanning the whole range. So we can send the difference between one sample and the next using coded with less bits than we would code the entire signal. So the simplest thing is we send the difference between samples and we encode them using, instead of our 8 bits for the sample, 6 bits for the difference between samples. This is a lossy compression technique in the sense that you can't represent all of the differences. If you do jump from one end of the spectrum to the other, you can't represent that. So when you decode your signal, you've lost some of the fidelity.
Just with this method, if there is just an error, all the rest of the signal would be false. Because if you have one difference that is false, the others also are going to be like with the good offset.
Yeah. Although you can sort of get around that by sending base signals every once in a while, sort of like you do again for video. Okay. So Another similar technique, adaptive PCM. You make a prediction of the next sample based on an observation of the previous samples. You code the difference between the sample and the prediction every once in a while. So we have a further reduced representation of our differences, but we use the number of samples to try and sort of more accurately recreate our signal.
Okay, so that gets us down to 32 kilobits per second. Okay, so how far can we take this? Well, we can try to represent our signal using only two levels that indicate you either go up or you go down. Okay. And so your signal either goes up or it goes down based on whether the actual signal is going up or down. Okay. Now, this is going to be not, it will roughly follow the shape of your original curve, but not terribly accurately. Okay. And so, again, you've reduced your data rates, but your quality is not great at all. And it's primarily used sort of in military applications where, quality is not an issue. So, all of those techniques are based on this idea of sampling our original signal and in some way transmitting those samples, whether directly or indirectly through a differential. Okay. So they are limited in sort of in how low you can drop the bit rate before the signal quality degrades significantly. So again, in terms of original voice cellular systems, those didn't really cut it. And so alternative approaches were explored where we modeled the human voice, sort of as a mathematical model, with a number of components, and we transmitted the parameters then for that model instead of the actual signal itself. So here, voice was divided into 20 millisecond segments, and each of those segments again was parameterized, and the parameters of the model were transmitted. Okay, so the most basic version of this is the linear predictive coding, And again, you see we get down to fairly low bit rates. Okay. But again, the sound for the basic LDC is going to be quite synthetic. So, there are additions beyond LPC that again allow the enhance the quality. Okay. So, how do we model our voice signal? Well, you have loudness, pitch. A vocal and a vocal tract model. Okay, and these, each of these would be a parameter or multiple parameters, and then those parameters are sent along. Okay. So the vocal cord synthesizer gives you a series of impulses. The unvoiced synthesizer gives you white noise. Your vocal tract model, again, is parameterized, and you send along those parameters. And pitch as well. Okay. And so the ultimate coefficients are derived using a minimum mean square error technique. Okay, so the bottom line of that is you have this parameterized model. You send along the parameters. Again, LPC does not give you terribly good quality. And so code-excited linear prediction was aimed to improve the quality of LPC, but without increasing the bit rate. And so what KELP does is it adds a sort of a library of residue values, so sort of what typical differences between the model and the actual system are, and at each point you just pick the one that's sort of closest to bringing you back to the actual system, and you send that, the ID of that residue value as well. Okay, and so in addition to your LPC signal, you add in the appropriate residue, and that improves the quality of your signal. Okay. And so this can be used to give you reasonably low bit rate and reasonably good quality voice signals. Okay, so voice is obviously an important type of data that's sent over these wireless links. Video would be another, and arguably compression is even more important than video, in the sense that video is significantly higher bandwidth, has significantly higher bandwidth requirements than voice. Okay. So, like our original voice compression techniques, video compression is
typically based on looking at the differences within images and then between one image and the next. Okay, so obviously what video is it's a sequence of images played out at a certain rate. Okay, so typically you might have 24 images.
As an example, 24 images per second, each image would have a certain size.
Okay.
But what we can observe is that within the image, there's a lot of sameness. Okay. So if you were to represent this image, your initial representation would be to give value, to split the image into pixels and then give a value to each pixel in turn. Okay. But what we can observe in images is that a lot of the pixels are going to have the same value. Okay. So we can reduce the amount of information that we need to represent this image by, instead of representing each pixel, give the value of the initial pixel and then indicate how many of the following pixels have that same value. Yes?
But what if we have like an image where all adjacent pixels are from different colors? Would the compressed image be?
Well, if every single pixel.
The ones that are not compressed?
Well, presumably would be the same. Because you'd be sending each pixel, you'd be back to sending.
You also have to store like the number of repeating value for each pixel. That would be. One in this case.
Yes. Well, possibly. I mean, that wouldn't. Yeah. No, it's probably true. It'd be unusual to have an image where every single value was different. But yeah, no, I think you're probably correct that you would actually increase the size of your file. But typical images hopefully have some pixels.
Just how do you say where these pixels are in the image? Because if you say there are, for example, 10 purple pixels, where?
Well, you have to have some sort of convention, start at one corner and move across the image. So that would have to be part of what you said was you would understand what the original image was. That's part of the coding, so you need to know. Yeah, what the original image would look like. Okay. So hopefully you can realize some savings by just, again, using the sort of similarity within an image. Typically, between images, you have a lot of similarity. So I can't even tell what the difference between these two is. Presumably, the guy is moving forward a bit from one to the next. But if you send, again, the differences, so what's different about the image versus the entire image, hopefully you can realize some savings in what you transmit. Okay. So typically there's encoding techniques are either constant or variable bit rate. So constant bit rate would probably use sort of different instead of using compression techniques, it would play around with the resolution of the image. So just use less pixels to represent the image, but the same amount per image. Variable bit rate would be techniques like spatial and temporal encoding, which are changing, you know, where the amount of information that you send is actually dependent on the image that you send. Okay, and all of the MPEG standards are based on some form of encoding like this. Okay. So, we now have potentially streaming, so we've been talking about with voice and video, streams of bits, and we have tried to reduce the amount that we're sending, but we have a certain amount to send. We can't rely necessarily on the bits getting to the other end unscathed. And so we need some method of determining whether or not our information has reached the opposite end correctly. Okay. And so in order to do this, we're going to encode our bitstream. And that means sending more information. So with source encoding, we tried to reduce the information we're sending. Now we have to increase the amount of information we're sending to try and detect and possibly correct errors. So, at the very least, again, we have to detect errors, and then we need to decide what to do if we do detect errors. And again, typically, if you're dealing with packets, you just chuck the packet and request that you resend or not, depending. So one way of detecting dealing with errors is just request that the in error data be resent. Okay. If you're dealing with streaming like voice or video, that's not going to work because by the time you get it resent, it's too late possibly. So, what can we do? Well, we can also attempt to do forward error correction. So, we send enough information that not only can we detect the errors, but possibly correct the errors. And so we're going to look at two classes of techniques. Block error detection, and then convolution coding, which will allow us to possibly correct for errors. Okay. So, again, if you've taken any basic networks class, you've probably talked a reasonable amount about block coding. And here, your data is sent in, is split into fixed size blocks. And you add some additional information, some additional bits to the block of data to allow you to detect the errors. Okay. For block encoding, usually you stop at detecting errors. And if you want to actually correct the error, you have to resend that block of data. Okay, so the easiest sort of block coding you can think of would be parity codes, so we'll mention them, and we'll see that they don't have great detection powers. And typically what's used for block coding is cyclic redundancy codes, which are very good at detecting errors. Okay, so your parity checks are good for, are sort of good just for understanding basically how the error checking works. So we have a number of data bits, and we want to add some information that allows us to see if our data arrives correctly or not. And the easiest thing you can do is to add parity bits. And what a parity bit is going to do is just check, well, whether one type of bit, zeros or ones, is odd or even. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 zeros. And so one method we can use is just saying we always want an even number of zeros. So we'll add one more zero to give us an even number of zeros in the block. So in this case, the block that's sent has 8 zeros in it. Okay, the block is our data plus our one additional. Okay, so if any of the bits change, what's going to happen? Well, if a 1 changes to a 0, you'll now have 9 zeros. So you'll know that something went wrong. If a 0 changes to a 1, you'll have 7 zeros. Again, you'll know that something went wrong. The problem is, if 2 bits change, if both those 1s change to 0s, looks fine. So it's sort of the minimal amount of information you can send, but it's not really great at detecting errors. But it gives you, again, conceptually an idea of how it would work. We can try and improve on that by doing multi-dimensional parity. And so here we divide our block, our data up into a block where you have equal sized rows, and then you do parity checks on the columns and parity checks on the rows. Okay. So if you have a single error now, that error will show up in the row parity check and the column parity check. So you'd actually be able to correct for a single error.
The problem is, if you have two errors, so say you have an error here and here, you now, again, can't detect that in terms of the row. You'll have two columns with parity check errors, but you won't know where they are. Gets worse. If you have four errors, then, again, they aren't going to be detected by either the column or the rows. Okay. So, conceptually, they're nice. These are nice to think about, and they're easy to think about, but they're not really great at improving your error detecting capabilities. More powerful would be the cyclic redundancy checks. And so these, it's very unlikely to not detect errors. Anything can happen, but it's difficult to get from one valid code word, so one correct sequence of bits, to having changed things sufficiently to have a second correct sequence of bits. Okay, so it's very reliable for detecting errors. Okay. It's based on polynomial theory, and also the likelihood of getting multiple different polynomials that divisible by each other. Okay. So we have our data bits, and we have a generator bit pattern, and what we'd like to do is choose our redundancy bits to add, and again, the way we choose it is so that our code word, our entire code word, is divisible by our generator. And so when we get to the other side, we divide again by our generator, and we should get a remainder of zero if we divide by our generator and get some non-zero remainder. Then we know there's a problem. Okay. So this can detect all burst errors of less than R plus 1 bits. So then it's very good at finding the errors. How exactly does it work? Well, our division is XOR operation, so all of our mathematics is done XOR, and again, we want to the code word we send to be evenly divisible by our generator. And so how do you decide that? Well, you add on your n zeros, and then you divide your data plus the n zeros by your generator. That gives you what your remainder is, and you tack the remainder onto the data. Obviously, that should be divisible by our generator.
Just do we need to know how to do these kind of things, or just understand that they exist?
To be honest, I've never asked the question about this, so just more understand they exist than roughly how they work. Okay. So again, for our division, how we exclusive OR everything. And so we start with our 1, 0, 0, 1 to divide in the exclusive OR with 1, 0, 0, 1. And if we drop down our next digit, we get 101. Obviously can't go in. Okay, so that's the 1, 1, 0, 0, 1 doesn't go into 101. So we drop the next digit 1, 0, 1, 0 into 101. It was a 1, 1, 0, and doesn't go into that. 1, 0, 0, 1 doesn't go into that. Drop another digit. It goes into that one, except XORing everything. We get 1, 0, 1. Drop the 0. The 1, 0, 0, 1, and you get a remainder of 0, 0, 1, 1. Okay. So, the word, the code word you would then send would be the original data with the it's actually one too many zeros on that with the 0, 1, 1 appended. Okay, so again, you have a general idea of how it works. In practice, this is the how the block error detections would be accomplished. Okay. So, block error, block coding is used to detect errors, and then it's up to the system, or a higher level of the system usually, to decide how to deal with those errors, whether it's worth retrieving the data or not. Okay. The idea behind convolution coding is that the system, sort of again at the level, can correct some of the errors. So built into the encoding, decoding is error correction facilities. Okay. The implementation costs are relatively low because it can be implemented in hardware. Now, this is a slightly more complicated approach. So I think I'll call a break here, and we'll clear our heads, and we'll talk about convolution coding when we return.